I'm Grady Booch, and this is my column on architecture, Dominant Design. I'm relatively fearless when it comes to driving in foreign countries. Assuming that there's no reliable and understandable mass transit available, I prefer to drive myself rather than be driven to and fro, for it gives me the opportunity to experience the country in a far more intimate fashion. Driving in Manhattan requires fortitude. Driving in Rome requires a good car horn. Driving in New Zealand requires attention to the sheep sleeping on the roads. Driving through Oman dictates politeness to the border guards carrying guns. But in all cases, driving requires that you remember what side of the road to drive on, so that you avoid the ultimate halting problem that is primarily manifest as a collection of squishy bits with increased entropy. There is no law of physics that dictates why 2/3 of the world's roads have traffic rules that keep vehicles to the right while the other third requires the opposite. Indeed, left-hand traffic used to be the norm, apparently even back in Roman times. But somewhere along the way, the trend flipped. The spread of the British Empire certainly contributed to the proliferation of left-handed ways. We restless Americans had our own reasons for doing things differently. Perhaps it was adolescent rebellion against our forebears, and thus the spread of our culture and our cars certainly contributed to the flip. In any case, there was a choice to be made with subtle economic, social, and pragmatic influences weighing in on each side. Yet once that tipping point was reached, sheer momentum launched a cascade of even more subtle factors that in turn increased the dominance of the right-hand rule. This is an example of dominant design, a concept introduced by James Utterback and Fernando Suarez to explain why some products win in the marketplace while others fail, even though neither may have been radically superior to the other. The choice of the VHS format for videotapes over Betamax is an off-sited example of evidence for the phenomenon of dominant design. In their time, both formats were touted as technically and visually superior over one another. Eventually, VHS, promoted by JVC, won, achieving critical mass in the market, and ultimately crushing Betamax, promoted by Sony. This market choice had large economic consequences for the respective proponents, and why VHS beat out Betamax became the subject of much armchair speculation. However, in the end, the dominance of VHS is now more of an historical curiosity. We've moved on to other format wars, and today the battles will be tomorrow's historical curiosities yet again. The past is rife with such examples that gave rise to frenzied punditry, only to end in the emergence of a dominant design that largely settled any debate. In some cases, there were truly compelling laws of physics that pushed the winning dominant design. Edison was a vocal advocate of direct current power, even to the point of conducting rather graphic demonstrations of the evils of alternating current through the electrocution of several unfortunate mammals. In the end, Tesla's approach won out because transmitting AC over long distances was significantly more efficient than DC. In other cases, choices were made, and because those products hit the market at just the right time and place, with the corresponding proper alignment of the planets, and even though they were not quite as good as any alternative, they won out. The dominance of the QWERTY keyboard is such an example. It evolved from the very practical solution of building a typewriter keyboard that didn't jam, even though it wasn't as optimal as the Dvorak layout, which was better suited to the use case of the typist rather than the typewriter. In other cases, dominance was assured by the weaving of elaborate patent thickets that decimated the competition and raised significant barriers of entry, the market further disrupted by the annoying actions of patent trolls. While you might think I'm alluding to some contemporary software patent case, I'm actually thinking of the drama that surrounded the Humble sewing machine in the mid-1800s. In yet another case, missed opportunities made the difference. When IBM came looking for an operating system for their yet-to-be-announced PC, they came to Bill Gates, who sold them Tim Patterson's DOS instead of striking a deal with Gary Kildall for CPM. The rest, as they say, is history, and the result, among other things, is the introduction of the term blue screen of death into the human lexicon. Future historians will likely wring their hands over the dominant designs that surround us today. Why did HTML come to dominate the web when there was a virtual primordial soup of alternative markup languages at the time? Why did Facebook come the dominant social network, rising above the many other nascent sites of its time? Why does Linux dominate the server and supercomputer market? Why did Justin Bieber overshadow the 2010 American Music Awards? These questions probably have no rational answer, but they do point out something deep about the architecture of software-intensive systems. The architecture of innovative software-intensive systems experiences many growth periods of growth and then collapse, with many periods of punctuated equilibrium in between. When you set out to begin to build a never-before-built system, the best way to proceed is simply by doing stuff. Fix what doesn't work, improve on what does, repeat. Once you've done this a few times, then and only then will you recognize the class of significant design decisions you must make, and the envelope of choices you have for each decision. Once the industry as a whole does this, then and only then will a dominant design emerge. You generally can't predict the winner. You certainly can't a priori know enough to even ask the right questions. It is only after you put a complex system out into the wild that you begin to know what the true architecture really is or what it should be. Does this mean I'm advocating architectural anarchy? Quite the contrary. My point is that while disciplined innovation requires considerable degrees of freedom to try things, delivering a quality system in a repeatable and predictable fashion requires a lot of tedious blocking and tackling, and that's what I mean by intentional architecture. There is no difference than the phenomenon we see in the evolution of businesses. Starting up a new business requires management that has a light touch, yet is decisive, but that kind of management is generally the wrong style to have once the company reaches a certain critical mass in the market. Founders of companies are rarely the best ones to lead their company into maturity, for different skills are required. Similarly, with software-intensive systems, you need subtly different methods to do something new than to continue to evolve an existing large legacy code base. The stable intermediate forms that intentional architecture offers us provides platforms on which innovations may dance. And once those innovators discover the steps, the system as a whole metabolizes those new patterns and moves on to the next stable form. Those new patterns become manifest as best practices and enter into the projects and the industry's tribal memory. This is the essence of incremental and iterative releases and why it's so important that a project exhibits such a rhythm. What becomes dominant in any project are those structures, those design decisions that optimally balance the forces that shape the system. What becomes dominant in the environment of that project, namely the economic niche in which that project competes, is more akin to the classic problem of hill climbing. Imagine a collection of ants trying to avoid water rising around them. Each will act such that every step moves the individual ant higher. Some ants will find a local maximum that, unfortunately, may still not be high enough. Others may have the good luck to find a hill that rises above the water. In both cases, each ant makes locally optimal decisions. Those lucky ants that survive, who reach the global maximum, we declare as dominant. The combination of being in the right place at the right time with the right local decisions is what lets them survive, and any number of small factors might have changed the life of any one ant. And so it is with software. Returning to the metaphor of the right-hand rule that began this discourse, the reality is that much design follows the rules of the road, as it should, but innovation flourishes where there's some wiggle in the traffic patterns. Innovation is also about forging new paths that others will eventually follow. In the life of a software-intensive systems, sometimes you take the road less traveled, most other times you follow more worn paths. In either case, one best does so with intention.